Hooked on Health, a Go Loud original.
Welcome along to week two of the Hooked on Health podcast with Eric Donovan. It is a Go Loud podcast original. I'm Will O'Callaghan from Off the Ball, producer on the show. Eric is back with us again for week two. Eric, how are you getting on?
Very well, Will. How are you?
Look, I'm good. I mean, I kind of have enjoyed the response to week number one. And at this stage, I think officially I can say, you were saying previously you didn't want to be just defined as a boxer. You are now officially a podcaster, my friend. At this stage, you can say you're officially a podcaster because that first episode with Oisin McConville, which people can listen back to on the Go Loud website or on the Go Loud app, that's out there now. And I'd imagine, look, you're probably enjoying the feedback you've been getting from that conversation with Oisin from last week too.
Yeah, it's pretty good, really. But Oisin's a great guest. Like, you know, he's a great talker and hopefully it'll all go the same way.
So our guest on week number two, Eric, I first saw Mary Hulgrain playing for Kildare in an All-Ireland final back in September of 2016. It was the All-Ireland Intermediate decider. It was the game just early in the afternoon at Croke Park as part of the triple header. Kildare, in the end, edged out Clare by 113 to 1-12. Usually in these games, player of the game will go towards whoever kicked the most frees or whoever kicked the winning point. But on that day, undisputedly, the best player on the field was the player in the goal for the Lilywhites, and that was Mary. She stopped Clare for multiple chances. She conceded one goal just before half-time, but made multiple clever saves coming off her line, particularly in the second half. It was a huge performance from her. She was described as the hero after the game, one player of the game, and then went on to be named the Intermediate All-Ireland Player of the Year too. Like, just a remarkable year in her life. But as we're going to learn throughout this podcast, there was a remarkable amount going on in Mary's life at the time away from football, which almost makes that achievement seem even more remarkable, really.
You're right. She did. She performed heroics that day, you know, and it's amazing what we can do. We're incredibly resilient and powerful and, you know, no matter what's going on for us, like, and Mary kind of illustrates that perfectly. Like, you know, during the discussion, she talks about what was really going on, gives us an insight into what, kind of troubles she was going through in life. And, you know, you would never have guessed that this was not, you know, the same person who was performing heroics in Croke Park and winning All-Stars and leading her team from the back line, from the goal line, leading her team to victory. So, you know, I have a lot of identification with Mary. You know, she talks about addiction as well and going down that road and her recovery too. So that's why I chose her, because I think her story is a powerful story, but it's also a very important one that needs to be heard by so many people.
I know for you, like, particularly since you met your fiance Laura, who has, you know, a background particularly in coaching in soccer, you've become more interested in women's sport in recent seasons than you probably would have been when you were younger. Is that fair to say?
Laura, I suppose, has made me more aware, you know, and I'm glad she has, because, you know, they did, you know, unfortunately for them, they have struggled with opportunity, equality, and the same supports and resources that are there for the men, you know. So it's been extra hard on the women, really has been hard on them, you know. And Mary talks about that, you know, in the early days, you know, she just had a desire and a passion and a determination to just play a sport, you know. And many times, you know, she had to get in and play with the lads, you know, that the same, she couldn't play with her own, I suppose, the girls, basically, because there was no girls teams. And that was it, you know, and that's sad, you know, which is not too long ago either. But Mary talks about it not, I suppose, affecting her. She didn't kick up a fuss or anything about it. She just put the head down and got on with it, you know. And thankfully today we're in a bit, we're in a different space with all of that, and there is a lot more opportunity and exposure and publicity around female sport, and there should be more. You know, we're going in the right direction though.
Yeah, I think, look, the argument would probably be as well, it might not have hurt Mary along the way that she was playing basketball against lads, football and ladies, and well, Gaelic football effectively when she would have been out with the lads rather than ladies football, probably even won't have hurt her early development. Because Eric, we're talking about an athlete here, and we'll let Mary tell her own story in a few moments time, but someone who seems to have been the annoying kid at school who was very good at a variety of things. I mean, she's gone over to America on a basketball scholarship while also being a good footballer at the same time as well.
Yeah, I mean, she was so athletic, you know, such an athletic person, and excelled through sport. And I'd say whatever she put her hand to, she would have been good. And definitely, I think operating with the lads from a young age, a bit like Katie Taylor, you know, when Katie Taylor was sparring with the boys as a young kid, it brought her on. And Mary too, you know, that brought her on to a whole new level. And she does, she goes off and she takes risks. And, you know, I think there's a lesson in that for everybody. You know, that, you know, if an opportunity comes, you know, seize it. And she did, and brought her across to America. So she tells us about those experiences in America and what brought her back and her road to redemption and recovery, which I think is really fascinating.
All right, well, let's have a listen to that conversation then that took place between Mary Hulgrain and Eric Donovan. Eric started by asking Mary about growing up and playing sport alongside the boys.
My brothers play, my cousins, I would have had a lot of cousins, like the lads, they were always a bit older than me. And I think it used to just bother me, Eric, that they were better at me to football, and they'd always be like, no, you can't play, you're a girl, you're too young. And soon enough, like when I got just as good as them, the boys had been nearly wanting me, and I get picked first on teams then, you know. But it was that kind of determination to be like, you won't tell me that I can't play, you know. It was like, tell me I can't do something and I'm going to do it better than ever. And look, maybe home wasn't great growing up and stuff, and I needed an outlet. And for me, sport was it. And it took me away from anything that was going on in my life. And it just, when I played sport, I was present. And I didn't have to think about my head. I didn't have to think about what was going on. And I think, for me, it was such a blessing to have sport growing up, because I could have went anywhere, do you know what I mean? And I really am. I was blessed to have it and to have people around me, to be in an environment that I could play.
What do you mean when you said, like, your brother said, you're a girl, you can't play? What? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, because like none of my friends, I suppose, were into sports. None of my friends that were girls were into sports.
Was there any girls' teams?
No, there was no girls' teams. There was no girls' teams until I was under 14. And like, I remember growing up and like even getting changed, I couldn't go into a dressing room with the lads. It was completely separate. Like you weren't able to do that stuff. It's completely different than what it is now. There's teams growing up for kids, girls, like under maybe sixes. But it wasn't until I was 14 that was there. Now, when I started playing basketball in secondary school, it was there. And through secondary school, it was there because it was an all-girls school. But through clubs, I grew up playing with the lads.
What was the name of that school, Mary?
I went to St. Mary's Secondary School in Naas.
Ah, yes. I know it well. I actually ran a few boxer size and fitness classes in there a couple of years ago.
The sporting facilities are brilliant there. And I was really lucky that I kind of landed there because, like, geez, even if you asked any of the teachers I had, Eric or Atten, growing up, like, I just brought a basketball everywhere with me. Like, I'd be going down the corridors in school and I walked to school with a basketball. I got the bus, I had the basketball with me. It became like just a part of me, and it was just an obsession for me. But like, even being in school, I'd go out at lunchtime, I'd go out during classes, like, and just be on the courts, and I never got any hassle. The teachers were brilliant. Like, they all just knew, like, that's what she wants to do.
It's quite clear that you had an unquestionable desire and determination just to succeed. Do you think that your time and experiences spent playing with the boys helped with your physical development and ability?
Yeah, I think physically, like, probably I was always a bit stronger than the girls then. And it was kind of that growing up with the lads, like, if you got knocked down, you didn't cry. Like, you got straight back up and you had to prove that you were just as strong as them, you know? So when I went in to play with girls teams then, like, physically I was much stronger. I even always remember, like, I used to love the Rocky movies growing up. Me and my brother used to love watching them, and yeah, every night before I used to go to bed, I used to hate this thing, like, of men's press-ups versus women's press-ups. And I'd be like, I'm not doing women's press ups. I'm not doing press ups on my knees. So every night before I used to go to bed, I used to try and do a man's press up, like a full press up, until I got it. And then I remember going into secondary school then and being able to just bang out like full press ups, no bother, and no one else could do that. And like the first year I think I went into secondary school, I did absolutely every sport possible. Now I don't know if I did it because I didn't really want to be in class and I wanted more time off school, or that I just wanted to put my hand to everything, but I played everything. I just love sport. I love competing. It was the competition that I loved, like competing against someone else and just having to be the best at it. And I actually think I won the sports girl out of the first, second, third and fourth year in first year. But like, I think mentally as well, playing with the boys growing up, it probably strengthened me a different level. I just always had this mental strength. It was like this resilience inside me that nobody was better than me. I don't know where it came from. Maybe it was from growing up through the boys. But like, I just had this thing in my head that like, I'm not better than anybody, but nobody is better than me. And I just grew up with that mindset. Like,
yeah, you've got that competitive nature. No, it's no wonder you went so far and achieved so much in sport. I'm just wondering, did you have any female role models growing up?
Janice O'Brien would have been the first kind of person. She was a good Kildare woman. She played football with Kildare and I grew up playing soccer with her then. And she was someone I looked up to. But like, no, my role models growing up were Eric Cantona, Ryan Giggs, Wright Dean. You know, they were them. With basketball, it was Allen Iverson, it was Michael Jordan. They were always male figures. No, I didn't. It's completely different than what it is today. Like,
it's so interesting to hear you say that, because, you know, my fiance Laura as well, like, her first role models were Steve McManaman, Robbie Fowler, you know what I mean? So
Liverpool fan.
Liverpool true and true. And I know you're a Man United fan. But anyway, I'm just wondering, do you think it's changing now?
I think there is. And I think like the likes of social media and the more media female sports get as well, it's only getting better. I know within the GA and within the football at the minute, like Lidl, even the sponsorships of like Lidl or TG4 have just elevated like where women's sports are on a social media platform. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, and like, even you'll hear young kids in schools growing up and their role models are the female footballers or female sports stars. Like, and I think social media and I think like different channels are like the likes of TG4 who've been brilliant with sports have a massive role to play in that. Like, I never would have seen a female sports competition on TV growing up ever. Like, even if it was a final, like I think maybe the Women's World Cup final might have been on Sky Sports or Eurosport. That's only where you got it. You never seen women's sports growing up. Like,
yeah, it's great to see, and not before its time either. There is a huge shift across the country and across the world, I think, in around female sport. We're seeing a lot more of it now as well, and you know, the sponsorship, the exposure and all that, it is on the up, and you know, rightly so. I mean, the hashtag as well, can't see, can't be, you know, it's never been more important. But it's people like you, Mary, you know, that had to put up with the tough times, you know, you had to overcome the obstacles and the hurdles, you know, to get into, you know, to help bring women's sport into this position. And whether you realize this now or not, but you know, your efforts throughout the difficult days have helped to pave the way for the next generation.
Where we are now in terms of male and female sports, so we wouldn't have believed it. Like, and like, will there ever be equality with men and women's sports? Like, who knows? But look, I think it's for female sports, it's only going to get better. And I think the level of like of athletes today compared to 15, 20 years ago with females, it's like, it's a different level. Like, when you watch like even like an old TG4 game of like women's football, like compared to now, the caliber and like the athleticism of athletes today, it's a different level altogether.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you. I've witnessed it for myself. You know, I've seen it with my own two eyes. And I mean this with no disrespect to girls' football, but it wasn't an area I was familiar with. And probably for the same obvious reasons as everybody else, the lack of exposure, etc. But, you know, since I started to go out with Laura, I've paid a lot more attention to it because Laura works in the area, she's coaching, she speaks so passionately about it. And back in 2019, I went to support her. She was coaching the under-15s and under-13s KDUL teams in the Gaynor Cup down in Limerick. And that tournament was on for a couple of days, and it was an absolute joy to watch. Just the ability, the levels, the passing, just it was fantastic. Such entertainment and really, really promising for Irish football going forward. But I remember Katie Taylor winning the Olympic gold medal as well in London, and there was a huge influx of young girls taking up boxing across the country. And for any of the conversations that I have with coaches as well, like, the general consensus will be that the girls, you know, are developing at a faster rate than the young boys, because they listen, they take on board what you're saying, they take on board the instructions, and they're more technically sound than the boys, which young boys can have a bit of an ego and, you know, a bit of macho-ness there going on, and they almost think they're ready and believe they're ready to fight from the minute they walk through the door.
Yeah, I think firstly what you said there about like the likes of Katie Taylor, like it's amazing the impact one person can have on such a bigger, broader scale. You know, once the mold is broke on something, then that's it. But it just takes one person to do that. And like for her, for boxing, like she's done it, it's been brilliant. I've coached men and women, like men and women's teams, and like the difference is like I think they're brilliant. Like women they listen better, they pick things up better. But then with the lads, you get like a completely different scale where like lads just don't think about things, they just go all in, which is sometimes I think is brilliant, because sometimes the women kind of overthink things. I think there's great pluses and minuses of both kind of male and female, like in sports. But I think the women definitely do have attention spans a bit more than the boys.
Mary, I want to ask you about your basketball career, because you know, you excelled at basketball and it took you on a bit of a journey. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I was in basketball camps in growing up in Waterford in Dungarvan, and there was American coaches kind of over at the camps, and I went for the first year, and a couple of coaches spotted me and said, look, you can play in America. And like this was already my dream. And I remember a coach saying it to me and I was like, oh my God, like do you actually think I'm good enough? Because I didn't have that belief in myself. And he said it to me, and then another coach said it to me, and then a couple of other coaches said it to me, and then by the time I was leaving the camp, I had a couple of numbers and a couple of this that they said, look, come back next year, keep getting stronger, getting better, and we'll see where you're at next year. And I went back to the camp next year, and they wouldn't put me in the camp next year. They said that I was too good. They actually put me as a helper in the camp, so I wasn't able to actually be in the camp, but I still played. I still worked hard for the couple of weeks I was there, and I got a couple more coaches seeing me playing, and they were like, no, like you need to start recording your games, start recording all your school games, get a highlight reel, and start getting in touch with coaches. So that's what I did. So I saved up. I bought a video camera, and I get someone to come to my matches in St. Mary's, and did video my games, and I put together a little highlight reel, and I had to include maybe one full game, and I had to make the VHS tapes. I had to make a couple of them. So I had to, There was no making. I wasn't able to make copies. So I had to make like loads of them individually. And I put them in envelopes and I sent them off to every school that had been in contact with me or that I got through the camp. And I must have sent maybe 50 off, like plus. And a couple of coaches got back to me, and I stayed in contact with them, sent them over more tape reels. And I had this thing in my head. I was going to the States, and I didn't want to be in school. I didn't want to sit my leaving cert. I had to sit the SAT exams. Now I set the leaving cert just because I knew I had to have it. But everyone was like, "What are you going to be?" The counselors in school were like, "You have to go into college." And I was like, "No, like I'm going to America." And I think they all thought I was stonewall mad. Like they were like, "What is this one on?" And I ended up leaving school, and I came home one day, and the bags were at the front door. The mother had said, "Look, you're either getting a job or you're getting out." And I said, "I'm going to America, and that's it." And I ended up sleeping on my mate's couch then for a week, and I moved to Belfast then for a couple of months. And I was up in Belfast, and I got the call off a coach saying, "We're offering you a scholarship. We need you over here in 3 days." I was walking through Queen's University. I'll never forget it. And I came back to Salins the following day, and I was on a plane a couple of days later, an Aer Lingus flight over to New York.
Wow. And what did that entail, Mary? Like, time-wise, you know, what were you going to study, location?
it was a 4-year scholarship. I actually kind of got a part academic scholarship with my athletic scholarship because I'd sat SAT exams and I had scored very, very high in the mathematics side of it. And they gave me a part scholarship with academics. So it was a full ride. I didn't have to pay for anything. It was pocket money. It was food. It was everything was covered. I just basically had to go over, play basketball and show up in school. And it was for 4 years. But I hit a tough injury the first couple of months I was over there and I had to redshirt, which means you're still in school, but you sit out your playing year. So I still had 4 years left. So I actually set out a couple more months than 4 years. I think I was over there for maybe 4.5 or a bit more in the end, just because of injury. So
how old were you when you went over?
I was just turned 17. I was 17 in the September and I was off on the flight in the December, just after Christmas.
And did it bother you at all being so young and being so far away from home, or did you take it all in your stride?
No, I think it was so surreal to me that I was just like, nothing bothered me. And I remember I got over there and I landed and the coach was there and I was in a van and like I knew no one. I was the youngest by a mile. I was after coming in the middle of the season. The season started in August, but I came in the January. So I was coming into a team that were already a bit bonded. I was in a dorm room on my own. I hadn't a clue of anything. And I remember just thinking like, my God, I am out of Ireland. I'm out of Salland. I'm out of that house. I'm out of everything I wanted to be out of. Like, I just didn't faze me whatsoever. To me, I was on cloud nine. Like.
Mary, I know you mentioned a few times about, you know, back in the house, it was tough. It was difficult a few times. And I'm just wondering, what was so tough about it that you were so hell-bent on getting out?
Yeah, I think it was just probably since I was young. Like, my dad was forced to leave when I was young. So I grew up with just my brother, my sister, and my mom. And look, my mother struggled with addiction and alcoholism, and she did. And it wasn't a great house to kind of grow up in at times. I got kind of, myself and my sister got separated from my brother then for a good while as well. And I always associated it maybe with just pain and suffering. And I didn't want to be there. It caused a lot of pain for me in my head. And it was just, I was never in the house. I was always either out playing football, always out, coming back late, just literally going there to sleep. It was only when I came into recovery myself, Eric, that I realized that I blamed her for a long time for all that. And only when I came into recovery and realized, you know what, like I have the exact same and it wasn't my fault. It wasn't her fault. It wasn't my fault. It was this disease that you have that you grow up with. And when that happens, like nothing else in the world matters. You just, you need to feed your addiction. And that's, I got great like forgiveness and relief through my own recovery for her with that, because I blamed her for so long. Like, just, it was like this growing up and like, you know, which, and I think my own recovery has helped me massively with that. Like,
yeah. And that's the thing about addiction, isn't it? Like, nobody chooses it, but once one person in the family gets addiction or struggling with addiction, it's not only the individual who struggles, the whole family suffers. You said you were separated from your siblings.
Yeah, so my mother was sent into a psychiatric unit for a while, and my sister and myself we were one aunt, and we stayed. It was actually only, wasn't too far from our house in the same kind of estate. So me and my sister went to stay with an aunt who was unbelievable to us, and my brother got sent to a different aunt. So we were separated for a time, but we were back together then as teenagers, kind of growing up. And myself and my brother would have always been really close, so I think it was something that, like, I found that tough, because me and my brother, like, Jez, he's just my world. I love that man to bits. Like,
yeah, just some people are just not lucky enough to be able to get the help, the supports that are available when in addiction, because person in addiction, they are powerless, really, and not everybody makes it into recovery, you know. But to hear you speaking and reflecting with forgiveness and with such maturity shows a tremendous amount of personal growth in you, Mary.
No, and I think a lot of people even say, like, or even people who've been in them situations, they feel guilt towards their children, or people say, how could you do that to your kids? Like, I don't understand. Like, you must be so selfish. And it's only through my own recovery I've realized that that woman was completely powerless to anything she did. You know, all she wanted was to get out of her own head. She was going through her own things. She'd been through her own pain, her own suffering. And it wasn't her fault. Like, she probably did that to survive. Like, that probably kept her alive. But, like, I got that compassion towards her through my own recovery, which was something I didn't have for 20 years. Like, Jesus, I struggled with that for 20 years. I used to hate the woman. Oh, like, and it just one day it clicked. Like, it was when I realized through my recovery and my head started to clear a bit. And I said, my God, like, I put absolutely anything below my addiction. Like, I just had, like, that was first. I would have stepped on anyone to feed my habit, you know, that way. So gaining that knowledge for me has been brilliant. It's been great freedom for me.
You are speaking with great empathy and compassion for your mother because of the path you went down yourself in life. I mean, you experienced firsthand all about addiction and everything that comes with that through your journey, and now have, like, would you say that has helped you to understand your mother, maybe identify with her and change your perspective?
I tell you what, I was in the States and I'd gone through, I had to have a reconstruction on my leg. I had a really bad injury. I had to have two surgeries. And then my last one was a reconstruction. And I came out of it and I was bedbound for, I remember, 2 weeks. They said, you can't move, like, in this position, 2 weeks. And I got hooked on oxycodone and OxyContin. And when I had to come off them, I couldn't. It was the first time in my life that, like, I got this tablet. And, like, not only was the physical pain gone, but, like, the emotional pain, the feelings, my head started to quieten, and I couldn't believe this. It was the first time it had happened since I was a kid that I was actually able to not feel. And I got that's where my addiction started. Like, because I grew up saying, you know what, I've seen alcoholism, I'm never going to do it. I didn't touch a drink until I was 17. I said, I don't want any part of that. I don't like, I'm going to be a successful sports person, and I'm going to have absolutely nothing to do with my mother or drinking or addiction or any of it. And minute I got them tablets, like, I'll never forget it. It was like this feeling of belonging, of this feeling, something I waited my whole life for. It was like this feeling of love that I never had. It was just, it took any feeling away from me, and that's where my addiction started, and it escalated from there. Then, you know, I was over in the States, and when the tablets were gone and I tried to come back into playing, the drinking took off then. And I came home then from the States. I actually came home because I have a little sister who I love to bits as well. And I'm only back in contact recently with her there since Christmas. Like, we hadn't spoken in a long, long time just because of addiction and my mother or whatnot. And I met her there at Christmas. So, and I speak to her every day. She video calls me every day now, but she was giving me phone calls over there saying, look, I can't deal with this. Like, she overdosed again last night, and I was listening to this in the States, and I just had this guilt in me that, like, oh my God, how could I leave her there? And I remember coming back that summer, and I remember seeing what was going on, and I said, look, I'm not going back to America. I can't. And I kind of almost used that crutch to say, like, you know what, like, I'm just gonna go now, and just went mad on the booze for a while, and that's where my 20s started. Then it was just Party City, you know what I mean? And it was kind of blame everyone else. Look, I'm back here because of you. And I always used that, you know, I never took responsibility for it. I always had that, look, you made me come back. You ruined my dream. So, like, don't say anything to me for going the mad one or going drinking for 4 days, like, you know.
So what age were you when you came back, Mary?
22, so 70. Yeah, it would have been 22.
So when you came back then, did you get back involved in football, basketball? I mean, did you get back playing sport?
Yeah, I came back, and I started back then. I think it was a couple of years I hadn't done anything. I said to myself, you know what, I'll get back into football and give me a bit of structure and a bit of direction, and maybe I might not kind of keep going as mad as I do, or it'll give me something to do. I was lost because I didn't have sport, and I was turning all my outlet then, it turned to drinking. And I said, no, maybe if I get back into sport. And it did. It silenced it for a good while. I got back in playing with Kildare. So I played a bit of underage growing up as well. But say that the level of basketball here, probably it was the football was far exceeding that. You know, it was, I wanted to kind of be where the kind of the best kind of structure was, and the best structure here kind of sport wise was with the football. So I went back into that playing with Kildare, and yeah, it quietened it for a while. It did, like, but it took off again. It wasn't long before it took off again, and like I was awful for tablets as well. Painkillers were a big part of my addiction. Big part of my addiction. And but I'd seen it growing up again. I remember when I was 10 and I came in and I'd hurt something in football, and my mother gave me 2 Ponson. She said, take the 2 of them. I think I slept for 14 hours. And I was only 10, you know, like, but that, like, yeah, me, that was just normal. And I didn't realize what I was doing to my body. So it was a mixture of tablets and drinking, and it was just, it escalated then further on to heavier drugs, which is like, and then in 2016, so we played the All-Ireland then with Kildare in 2016. And like, I was in the height of my addiction that year.
Really?
And, oh, like the height of it. Like, and I'd nowhere to live that year. I was sleeping in my car. I'd lost everything through addiction. My sister was, I hadn't spoken, she was gone. I'd lost the license. I lost the license for 3 years after being in court again for the third time. I'd no mother. I'd no father. I was living in my car. My brother, I wasn't able to see my brother because I'd no way of driving down because, like, I'd no license. So to me, I was just, I'd lost everything. And only when my Kildare manager that year, he got me the house that I'm actually living in today. He said, look, show up here. And he kind of questioned me. He said, like, why is there pillows and duvets in your car coming training? And I kind of brushed it off. And he said to me again, he said, what's the story like? And I said, look, I'm struggling to get somewhere to live at the minute. And I think that was a Tuesday morning. And by a Tuesday night, he had me at a house. And he said, look, what do you think of this? And we got to the house and the place was just a wreck. And he said, look, what do you think of this? We'll fix it up, yeah. And I said, look, it's perfect. Like, can I move in tonight? And the man went and got me a mattress, a bale of brickets and a fire log. And I slept in there for 3 or 4 months with no electricity, with just me and my dog. Like, and like we built the house up from there. And it's the house I'm living in today. Like, you know, it's a home today. It's something I never had. It's my home.
What was the manager's name?
Alan Barry. Great man. He's from Newbridge. He's a Sarsfields man. And I'll forever be grateful to that man for what he did for me, you know.
It's great to hear you talking about your manager. You know, I can identify with that, like, because, my own club coach, he would have helped me out a great deal in life, you know, and I would have let myself down, I would have let the club down, but, you know, my coach, Dominic O'Rourke, I'm talking about here, like, he would have helped me out a great deal, and he never gave up on me, you know, even in all those times I let him down, but, you know, there's you talk about your manager as well. The coaches, the length and breadth of this country, they do a tremendous service to society, like, especially the volunteers, the grassroots level, you know, just to go above and beyond. And we're very lucky. We're very lucky to have people like that, I suppose. But so that help that Alan gave you, I presume then that would have been like, gave you a new start and almost like gave you a foundation then to kind of kick on in life, yeah?
It didn't there. I think my drinking took off more. Like, my darkest times, like, in my addiction, when I think about it, is sitting in that house on that mattress on my own. And I was happy. What I thought happiness was I had enough cans and enough drugs there to keep me going, that I was going to be able to go to sleep and I wasn't going to have to worry. I was going to be able to go to sleep and not be in my head, you know? But like, I wasn't at my rock bottom yet, and I had to go there. And like, I mean, we played the All-Ireland 2016, and like, I remember Alan texted me that morning, and he said to me, this was on the Saturday, we were playing on the Sunday, and he said to me, Alan would kind of give me a dig out in the house, and I think he'd known what was going on. He'd seen like bottles, cans, I think he had an idea, and he texted me and he said, look, like, just don't have a tipple tonight. Like, and I remember thinking, when I got this message off, I remember thinking, like, I said, what's a tipple like? I didn't know what a tipple was. So I remember Googling it, right? And I remember saying, Jesus, this lad thinks I'm an alcoholic or something. I didn't speak to him for so long after that, because I had this resentment against him, saying, like, who do you to say who I was? But I was saying that, Eric, I had 8 cans the night before that All-Ireland final, because I said to myself, I'm going to go easy tonight. I'm going to be ready for tomorrow. I'm going to play in a good match. So just don't go too mad. And I said, right, I'll have enough to get me through the night that I can fall asleep. So I had 8 cans. And there's me saying to myself, like, who does he think he is telling me not to have a tipple tonight? Like,
yeah.
And I didn't speak to that man for months. I had this resentment against him, like, you know. But, like, I had to go a bit further. Had to go to my rock bottom. And the end of 2017 then, you know, I was on my knees. And I managed to, with the grace of God, make my way into recovery. Like, you know, I was on my knees. I was suicidal. I had nothing left of me. I wasn't living at all. It was just mere existence. And I couldn't do it anymore. And I somehow had this strength inside me to ask for help. And I did. And it was the best phone call to this day that I've ever made in my life. To a man that I knew had stopped drinking. And all I did was ring him and say, I need you to help me to stop drinking. Because I knew drink was the start of it. You know, drink came first and then everything else came after. And it was the best phone call to this day that I've ever made in my life, you know.
So you made the phone call, Mary, and that was the start. And what did you do from there?
I think reaching out was the start, you know, reaching out. It doesn't matter who it is, someone you trust, someone you love, or someone you think that might just have a bit of advice that can help you. The reaching out was the first thing. Trying to get clean and sober for me then was the next thing, because I had these demons in my head for so long, and like the substance for me had silenced that and it kept it at bay. So when the drink and everything else was taken away from me, like, Jesus, the demons got louder and the voices got louder and that inner critic started screaming at me, you know. So I think probably like the toughest time I probably ever had really was when I was in early recovery. The drink and drugs were taken away from me and I was just left with me. Like, to me, that was the hardest part of my recovery. But I got through that, and look, I came into recovery 3 years ago. I struggled for 3 years. Like, I didn't get it. I was in because I felt I had to be there. I knew I had a problem. I really knew I had a problem. I knew a long, long time ago I had a problem, but I wasn't ready yet. And like, my recovery changed then last year when I said to myself, right, I want this now. And it wasn't for anybody else. I wanted it for me. And when I started building that relationship with myself, and instead of having been told, here, you have to go to this meeting, you have to show up here, you have to do this, you have to do that, I was the one picking the phone up and saying, here, I need to go here, I need to do this, ringing someone saying, here, look, I'm in a bit of bother here, is there any way you can give me a bit of advice? And when I started doing that, my recovery changed. I wanted it, but I wanted that relationship for myself, and I wanted to live for myself, not for anybody else.
Well, that's what addictions are anyway, aren't they? Like, they're crutches. Crutches to help us to get through life. Crutches to help us to cope with life on life's terms. I'm talking about people in addiction. You know, whether it's mental health issues or emotional issues or whatever, the crutches are obviously providing some sort of service at that time. But you clearly wanted to stop. And, you know, but stopping can be difficult. It is difficult because you put down the crutch and now suddenly you're left exposed to these powerful and emotional feelings, and you're trying to deal with them naturally and organically. You clearly understand that the addiction is not the solution anymore, because it's just a masking tape. It's not dealing with the real issues. But you said, I had to look at myself. No, you were determined to find a different strategy to cope with life. How do you get there? Who helps with that? And what resources were available to you?
Yeah, so I think developing that relationship with yourself is something it takes time to learn how to do, because like, I was always looking for that escapism. Always. No matter what it was, it could have been like through exercise or through working out. It could have been through food. You know what I mean? I'd find escapism in a jar of Nutella. Like, it was just something to take away from me. You know what I mean? Just because I could not sit with myself. I was not able to just... I was always looking for something else because I wasn't able to find approval in myself. So, like, I had to stop running. I was running my whole life since I was a kid. I always say I always had the ASICs on. I was always running away from my problems, and I had to start facing them. So, like, reaching out was the first thing, admitting I had a problem. That was the first thing I had to do. Then I had to start showing up. I had to do the suggested things, which was, like, there's great services. Like, there's Alcoholics Anonymous, there's CA, there's NA, there's great free services out there that, like, people don't really know about or that, but, like, they're unbelievable, and they've been unbelievable to me. So it was to attend them, and to attend them regularly, every day. I had to do that, and Like, if I had a problem, I had to pick the phone up. There was no saying, I can deal with this now. I'm Mary. I can deal with this myself. Like, I have this strength inside me that I don't need help off anyone. It was to be vulnerable and to say, right, I need help here, because like, I had to change absolutely everything. And it was through them rooms, Eric, that I got the tools I needed for recovery. I had to get outside help as well, which is something I still do, and I probably will still do for a long, long time, because it's been brilliant for me. And I had to find someone I connected with. Like, I'd been to a lot of counselors, a lot of psychotherapists, a lot of everything. And like, I go into people and I'd sit there and I'd say, no, I'm not connecting. Do sit there for the hour, hand them money and say, yeah, I'm never going to see you again. And that was my perception of counselors. And I had to keep trying, and you have to keep trying till you find that connection with someone. And when you get it, then boom, that's where you go and talk. And that's where you pour out everything. You get very honest with yourself. Now, like, you don't just go and tell someone what they need to hear. You have to be honest with you. And that's something I learned through recovery as well. Like, I heard someone saying once before, you have three faces, you know, you have the face you show the world. You have the face you show your close friends. And then you have the face that's you. That's really you. And to be honest, like, that last one is what you need to show constantly. And when you put your head down on the pillow at night time, you need to say, you know what, I lived an honest day. And like, that brute honesty and that, like, that really has helped me with recovery and life, because I don't have to live in fear anymore. You know, I used to be always like, I used to have a different mask for all my different groups, my football friends, my basketball friends, my drinking friends. I used to have a different mask for everything. And like, today I'm just me. I'm just my, like, and it's the relief and the freedom of having that, like, is unbelievable. I got them tools in the rooms of recovery through AACA and NA, like, you know.
You know, Mary, I have loads of identification with you around addiction. My own addictions have taken me to some really dark places, and, you know, would have spent a lot of my time searching for oblivion and just not able to cope with life on life's terms, you know. But thankfully today I can, you know, I have the tools to deal with life now. And I suppose we're some of the lucky ones, you know, that we've found recovery. And sadly, not everybody makes it. But the services that you talked about, it's great to hear you talking about those services, the free services, and to hear you talking about therapy and counselling and all that as well. That's so, so important. And I will always use my profile and platform to talk about that too, you know, because that has been a tremendous help to me in my life. So, you know, it's just great to hear you speak like that. And I think your story is going to help so many people. But come here, in the middle of all of that, you were winning All-Ireland titles. You were performing heroics in Croke Park in front of thousands of people. Tell us about that.
I remember, like, the crowds were rolling in the second half in that game, like, and I remember standing in the goal. First of all, I remember walking around Croke Park behind the band, and I just saying, oh my God, get me out here, like, I just do not want to be here, like.
Yeah.
I remember then in the second half, like, and crowds start rolling in, and I remember just standing looking in Croke Park, and I was just like, I don't know if I kind of came through a bit or started to sober up a bit or what. And I was just like, what the hell is going on? Like, where am I? Like, and I just, like, I got this moment of being present, and I just, Jesus, there was 50,000 in Croke Park, Eric. And to me, yeah, I was standing there on my own, you know. I was just so alone, so lonely. I didn't want to be there. I just was thinking, you know what, the session's happening after and I'll get away with murder then. I didn't care if we won or lost, because I knew that was the last game. You know, either way, win or lose, that was the last game. And, like, that's where my head was at, like. And it's sad when you think about it now, but, like, to think, I don't even know how I got through that year, really, or, I don't know, it was just this resilience just to keep going, you know. I think I had that from growing up, like, just keep going no matter what. If you fall back down, just keep going, you know. Everything passes, you know, everything will end.
It just goes to show you that we never know what's going on for an individual or a person. Like, and I suppose anybody who was in that stadium that day or watching you on TV would never have guessed that you were thinking that way, that you were feeling that way. I mean, you played out of your skin. Like, you performed heroics that day, and your performances all that year were excellent, but particularly on that day, in that final against Clare, you were outstanding. And
you know, that cemented your place on the All-Star list, and you won the All-Star that year as well, and rightly so. I'm just wondering, does something change inside of you, like, when that whistle goes? Like, when you have an objective in front of you, like something you can see, something practical, do you just transform and leave all of your worries and cares behind you and just almost just for the duration of the game, just focus at on the job at hand?
Yeah, I think sport gave me that. Like, I think it gave me that little bit of freedom that no matter what I had going on in life, or no matter what problems, or no matter what was going on in the outside, when I got into the arena, so to say, like, it was game on, you know, everything was gone. It was just me, and I was like a kid again in my playing field, and I was able to just be free. And like, sport gave me that, and I think that's why it saved me in a way, for like, it really did for so long. But like, I always had that, like, that winner's mindset, Eric. I know you can relate to that. Like, it's just that nobody was better than me. I just had to be the best, and no matter what I did, like, it was something that was just drilled into me, I think, from growing up. Like, I'll tell you a story about the All-Ireland as well. I hadn't seen my dad in a long, long time since I was very young. Like, and I was in the pub a couple of weeks later, in Salins, out for a drink or whatever, and a man came up to me and he said, geez, it was great to see your dad in the stands in Croke Park. And I said, what do you mean? Like, and he said, I saw your dad walking out with Croker that day. I was chatting to him. And he said, geez, I hadn't seen the man in 20 years. And like, this was a couple of months like after. And oh my God, still to this day, like, it still touches me, like, because
wow.
I hadn't known that day, like, that my dad was standing in the stands watching me. Like, you know, it would have been completely different, like, you know. Someone had seen him. They'd been up from Salins. They'd been up at the match, and they'd seen him walking out of Croke Park, and they hadn't seen him in 20 years, but they recognised him, and they said, oh, what's the story, Jim? How are you? And I got to know him later then through recovery, he told me he had absolutely every newspaper clipping of me from that year and everything growing up, and actually, he was proud as punch, like, you know. He had a stroke. He wasn't too well, and I actually just gave him a text. Out of the blue, I was only in early recovery. I said, look, I know I haven't spoken to you in a long, long time, and I don't, you probably don't want to speak to me, but I hope you're okay. I heard you weren't too well. And I met him in a little cafe in Kilcullen following week, and geez, I was so nervous. And he contacted me every day since then, and you know.
Oh, Mary, that's just brilliant. I'm getting emotional here listening to you. Amazing story. Do you think you would have played as good if you knew your dad was in the stands?
I don't think I would have drank the 8 cans the night before.
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant.
But it's something that, like, because, like, you know yourself, like, Gare, like, I didn't feel for so long. I was never able to feel emotion. Like, you know, I was never able to feel empathy or compassion or anything until I came into recovery. And, like, still to this day, when I think about it, like, that he was sitting in the stands watching me, like, proud as punch, like, it's just, it still gets me. It still does get me first emotional. You know, it's a great memory to have in the midst of all the darkness that was going on then, you know.
Well, I want to wish you and all of your teammates, the Lily Whites, the very best of luck as you go in pursuit of more glory this year. I'm just thinking back to your story, and, you know, Mary, thanks so much for your honesty. You've been so brave and honest and sharing with us on this level, and I think it's so important. I mean, I firmly believe that in order for us to be able to address an issue or do something about a problem, we have to acknowledge it. We have to take ownership for it. We have to talk about it, put it out there. And you speak about that so well, and about that process. And there's lessons in that for everybody. But what a transformation in your life. You came back from America. You're so young. You know, you had no mother in your life at that time. You had no father in your life. You're disconnected from all of your siblings. And it was just you and your dog. And the kind of picture that paints is like a hopeless place. And through the help of some very important people, you managed to get back up on your feet. And then suddenly you're winning All-Ireland titles. You're performing heroics. You're winning All-Stars. You found recovery. And you're in a great place in life. And you've opened up your own gym. You've opened up your own business. I do see you there training people, inspiring people. I mean, how did that all happen?
Yeah, so I got into the fitness industry when I came back from kind of America. I had a lot of rehab to do and stuff from injuries, and I kind of fell into strength and conditioning, and I kind of said, look, this kind of interests me, this is where I want to go, and I became a personal trainer, and I did that for a long time. I opened a little place in Salins years ago, I kind of went out on my own, and then I played the tape forward, and I've my own gym now. It's called the Compound Training and Recovery. I opened it kind of up last year after the first lockdown, kind of the bigger kind of part of it. And we got shut down fairly quick, but it's ready to go again as soon as the lockdown lifts. And we've a great community there. We've developed a great crew, and it's just I love what I've made there, Eric. It's not like a regular gym. You don't go in. There's no mirrors. There's a sign at the door saying leave your ego at the door. You know, people come in. I just want people to be the best versions of themselves, you know, believe in themselves, come in and have a bit of crack, you know, work hard, but at the end of the day, leave smiling, knowing that you gave everything for the hour and you had fun doing it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Take responsibility and ownership, and have a little bit of belief in yourself, you know. And if you've only trained a day, or you've been training for 10 years, you come into my gym and you get treated with the exact same respect and the exact same level. And I'll give you the exact same commitment, to anybody that comes in, you know, because, and that's why I love the classes. Someone can train, someone who's been around 20, 30 years in the business, or a personal trainer, to someone who's just a newbie. And I think you'll connect with people in the likes of that situation. Like, you'd never talk to the likes of those people outside of the gym, but you come in and have the crack. And look, there's great slaggings, which I love about the gym. Everyone just, there's no seriousness. Everyone just takes the piss out of each other. Everyone gets in, works hard, and, look, it's fun, which I think at the end of the day is important. And it helps people internally as well as externally, which is something I'm passionate about, you know. And I can't wait to open back up. I can't, because I have the online thing, which is great, but you don't have that connection of being in the gym with people. You know, you need that social interaction, that connection with people. And I can't wait just to get the lads back. Jesus, it's going to be... Yeah. It's going to be a big year, and even after all the setbacks and everything, I have great hope, and I love that word. It's one of my favorite words. Without hope, we have nothing, you know. And it's just a matter of time. Everything's going to pass, and this will pass, and we'll all be back to our lives in no time, you know. We will.
Yeah, it's a very important industry that you're working in, and I actually think it's going to be even more important in the aftermath of COVID-19. Many people will be looking to regroup and rebuild and kick on again. Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It really has. Thank you for sharing your story with us. I think it's an inspirational story. You're an inspiration and a role model, and I think you should keep telling your story and keep talking about it, because you're going to offer so many people out there some comfort, hope, and inspiration. So thank you for being my guest on the Hooked on Health podcast.
Eric, thanks so much for having me on. It's great to chat to your brother, as always, you know.
So that was Mary Holgrain in conversation with Eric Donovan. Eric, remarkable story that Mary has. Again, a few things that I probably zone in on when I'm listening into it. And the one that really kind of jumped out to me, we mentioned at the outset of the podcast that you go back to 2016, and for most athletes, that's the crowning glory, is the opportunity to play at Croke Park, the opportunity to bring your county to an All-Ireland title. And for Mary, with the struggles that were happening in her life at the time, to be sitting down drinking 8 cans on the night and into the morning of the All-Ireland final, that to me makes it all the more remarkable that she performed as well as she did in the early afternoon of that September day.
It's amazing, Will, isn't it? It's quite remarkable, to think. And you would never have guessed that. Nobody would have ever guessed that.
Wouldn't have had a clue.
Not in a million years, because of her performances. But, when a person's in active addiction, most of the time, they don't have the tools to be able to deal with whatever, upcoming events or big occasions. And, they'll find solace and comfort in the drink or the drug or whatever it is. And that's the way it was for Mary. That's how she dealt with it at that stage. But once that whistle went, she just transformed into this superhero, basically, and smashed it on the day. But incredible story.
Well, the thing as well, my heart was breaking when I heard about the idea of Mary coming back from America and being so far away from her family, and then hearing the way things were for her family and things getting broken up, and then having to deal with that and live in her car and all those kind of horrible moments trying to find a home. I actually found it quite uplifting when I heard about the fact that she was able to reconcile with her dad and has been able to do so, particularly in recent years too, because, you know, it's an unusual way that they reconnected, that her dad was going along to the All-Ireland final out of his sense of pride without being able to even admit that to his daughter, where the relationship was broken down. But I was so glad that at least that chance encounter with a neighbor was able to make them reconnect again.
Yeah, it was a beautiful part of the story, wasn't it? Just really moving. And, you know, funny when I said to her about if you knew your dad was going to be there, do you think you would have performed as good as you did? She said, I might not have drank the 8 cans. It was a great encounter, and it's a nice story. You like to hear, because, like, you know, she spoke about how close she was to her dad and, you know, how much that impacted her and affected her when they disconnected, you know, all those years ago. And, you know, he came back in at the right time, and he was in the right place at the right time, I suppose, to be able to see her, you know, perform the way she did. And the fact that they've reconciled ever since has been a really lovely, turnaround of the story. And it adds to it.
Because God, I'd imagine, like, whoever has to make that first text message or phone call to actually get the lines of communication back open again, when so much time has passed, that really can't be an easy conversation, I would think.
No, it can't. You know, some of the biggest challenges we have in life are the relationships that we have with people, you know, and in many cases, the most troubling ones are the ones that are closest to home, you know. I'd say it was tough, but like as Mary said, she grew, you know, she's grown. She's grown as a person. She's grown as a human being, as an individual, and she has the tools today to be able to deal with life on life's terms, and she's able to reconnect with the people that are close to her. And you know, she's so mature, you know, listening to her. And the other thing as well about this is one of the reasons I want to speak, because, like, we don't hear many females speaking out in this capacity, you know, but females are struggling as well with addiction, you know, with mental health issues. They're not exempt, you know, but we just don't hear many females speaking out. And that's one of the main reasons why I want Mary to share her story, because she helps so many people in her gym, and, you know, with their physical health, but also with their mental health. And her story is just an inspirational one. And the more she talks, I think the more she's going to reach out to people. And, you know, speaking to her afterwards as well, I know she said to me, like, I feel a little bit uneasy, you know, from speaking out so openly and honestly. And I said, Mary, I do feel the same. Anytime I speak out, I feel the same. It's almost like I'm a little bit exposed. But I said, do you know what? You're going to gain so much more from that. It's not easy. That's why people don't speak out in the first place, you know, because it's tough. It's one of the toughest things to do, to speak out. Public speaking actually is one of the toughest things to do in the world. It's the biggest, you know, there was a survey done that the biggest fear in the world is public speaking, even ahead of dying for some people, you know. So to be able to speak out openly and honestly like that and share your experiences to life, the ups, the downs and everything in between, that to me is incredible. That's what inspiration truly is. And, you know, it's a testament to the kind of woman that she is, and she's going to help so many.
And I hope those meaningful conversations that our listeners are getting from this podcast is what they're really going to enjoy. Next week, I mean, we mentioned at the outset of the series, Eric, you retired briefly from sport, but then got back into it. We're going to be talking to someone who retired from sport on next week's podcast here on Hooked on Health. And again, we're talking about someone who's like a massive achiever, 2-time European indoor champion, one of Ireland's best sprinters ever, retired, you know, not in the absolute fullness of his career, but still for what many people would have felt quite early, goes on then and totally reinvents himself in terms of being a broadcaster, in terms of being a person who's in front of the camera, winning MasterChef Ireland, now becoming, only just a few weeks ago at the European Indoors, he was part of RTÉ's broadcast team, has covered an Olympics back in 2016 in Rio, down on track as a trackside reporter too. I'm really looking forward to you chatting to David Gillick.
Yeah, me too. I think Dave Gillick is just he's a legend of athletic racing, and you know what, an incredible guy, 2-time European champion, and he's been there, he's done it, Olympian, and as you mentioned there as well, like, you know, with the MasterChef and the TV work that he's done, he was brilliant in the Rio Olympics. Just remember the work that he was doing out there. It was incredible. The insights he was given was great. So I'm looking forward to speaking to him. He's a very interesting story.
Yeah, I always find athletes on athlete conversations. It's why he's really good trackside too, because he has lived this. He knows what it's like to be at a major championships, and he will know the elation of a good run or the disappointment of a bad run, and probably knows exactly the same questions to put to the person that he would have received at the same time. I always find it's interesting when you get an athlete's perspective on that. David's going to give us a perspective as well next week, Eric, on the idea of retirement too. And I guess kind of the way the time can span out in front of you when you've had a goal, and in his case, to be one of the top 400 meter runners in the world, is everything he does from a young age right up till he's about 30. And then after that, there's just so much more time left in life afterwards. And something I find very interesting about Eric that we'll get into with him next week is that you've got to readjust sometimes, and you've got to maybe reset and find a way of doing something totally different.
Life after sport is very difficult. It's difficult to adjust because for like whatever, 15, 20, 25 years, they could be so consumed with sport from the minute they open up their eyes in the morning till the time they shut their eyes at nighttime. It's just everything evolves around the sport, whether that's running, swimming, football, whatever, you know, even from the food, the rest, the training, the planning, everything. And sometimes other areas of their life can struggle in other areas of their life and other areas of their lifestyle. So David Gillick, I've heard him speaking about it before, and so I'm going to ask him how he managed to adjust and transform through that period of his life.
That is going to be week 3 of the Hooked on Health podcast with Eric Donovan, a Go Loud original podcast. We will be back next week. Hopefully you'll join us as well to listen to David's story and what he's hoping for in the future too. If you want to listen back, you can catch the first episode, which was with Ushi McConville, the former Armagh and Cross McGlen star. It's available on the Go Loud app and the Go Loud website. You can also pick it up wherever you get your podcast from. Eric and I will be back next week.